It's a short introductory book about Buddhism. It opened my eyes on a deep level as to how much you are overly in your own mind. It got me to constantly wonder, what does the word I mean? Does I necessarily start and stop at the body's boundaries? Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. For 4 days, I did not play with myself or even think much about sex. The questions took me away from all that me stuff for that length of time. The car was in the garage, so to speak. End of aside. The jerk-off list again, this time without the effect or use of corn and chat rooms. Presented now, sooner rather than later, is a blueprint on how to jerk properly. Yep, you heard me right. How to jerk properly. Jerking off, you're doing it wrong. That'll be the tagline of my 60-second YouTube promotional clip, if there is one. List, again, will be in reverse chronological order. 8. Snooze or cruise. No change on this one for this run-through. Your post-jerk activity consists of having a snooze or a cruise. You have a snooze or go and do something else easy. Both options are appealing after you have finished a good jerk. What I would say though is, after you have completed one task fully, doesn't that free up the mind better so it can move on to another task? 7. How was it for you? This is different this time. After the nut, if that mind of yours has come up with a naughty scenario all of its own creation, then you'll feel rather pleased with your own work. Rather pleased indeed. Job completed. Job well done. You'll feel two things. You'll feel two things. A sense of accomplishment and a sense of completion. For importance, I repeat. A sense of accomplishment and a sense of completion. How often do we get to feel those things these days? To emphasize, feeling a sense of accomplishment post-completion is key to jerking well. The nagging, dissatisfied feeling experienced having taken a shortcut to a jerk is what we leave behind us. No more of that, why did I jerk off to that shit? I'm not even into it. That goes because you'll have just jerked off to your own stuff. It was your own stuff and not somebody else's. So you must have been into it. 6. The nut. As mentioned earlier, you'll come great. It's like you carry momentum from one stage onto the next and the next. It makes the finish stronger. Your pipes will be nicely cleared out. Because of that, you will not need to go jerking again for ages. Freedom from that frustrating loop of never quite taking care of the job. Why? Because you have just very effing nicely taken care of the job. 5. Mind overload. This happens just the same without screens showing corn or chat rooms as it does with. That may come as a surprise, but it does. Let me ask you a couple of convincers. How long has jerking off been around for? Seriously, guess. How long has the net been around? The point is that the male body has been well able to jerk off without the need for screens for like 50,000 years. There is some know-how already there in the body, you know?
To egg the point, picture your great-granddaddy lying there in the long grass. Age 14 with codger in hand. What material did he have to use? Nothing but the blue sky or the insides of his own eyelids. He got the job done, didn't he? Didn't he? Why can't you? Time to take up the mantle and carry on this valuable skill so that it may pass on to the next generation. They say that lighting a fire with tinder and flint bridges the eons between now and our prehistoric descendants. Ditto for jerking. For those of you who have grown up and only known jerking with screens, please contemplate this point. I hope you afford yourself the opportunity to jerk only using your mind's eye as a source of material and come to know what that is like. You can do it. Continuing our countdown on how to do this the right way. 4. The search for that something something. This is different. This time you get no assistance from clicking around a screen for hot stuff. Some of you may not like the sound of that. Not so easy for an addict to do, you may think. Please bear with me, I've got this covered. If you lock yourself in a private room, leave all devices outside the room, no music, no radio, no audio, no distractions. Your eyes are not looking at any screen. Your eyes are darting around beneath your own eyelids. Care of, insert your own name here, dirty little mind, you'll start to see erotic scenarios play out. That something something of which you seek will come into your own mind. It will. To repeat this important point, if you give your mind a blank slate and some time, then, from side stage, will enter some juicy, erotic thoughts, all of your own ego. One of those will be the one you latched onto, the one you get massively focused upon as if you were right there inside that thought. When that happens, you'll easily roll on to step 5, mind overload. You'll surprise yourself with the good stuff your own mind will come up with. It'll get you there. So here's a snag to call out. And while doing so, here is that snag's upside. The snag is this. It can take what seems like an age before your mind hits upon a winner something something scenario. But the upside is this. Because you have worked for it, it makes the nut way better. Now that I have set the context and given full detail, here's a little rhyme to embed that new idea into memory. If you ain't working, you ain't jerking. Indulging your impulses for instant gratification got you into your old bad habits. Earned gratification is your way out. As mentioned before, the nut will reliably be a good nut that you feel good about. You'll be like, I nailed that. And have a mind cleared and ready to tackle your next activity with focus, whatever that is. You'll be able to stick at it for longer too. Basically, you get all that time back. As with the first version of this list, there are some special notes for this step 4. A. They say that in the absence of corn, just use your imagination. Nah, that's wrong. That's too wishy-washy to action. Instead, how about you start with a real-life, close-to-home, potential sex scenario and then you play it out in your head so that this time it winds up with a tryst. I'm talking scenarios of seduction and conversion and how about a little subversion that ends with her saying, I can't believe that just happened. Note B. In the previous run-through of the jerk sequence, I explained all about the dopamine circuit and how it gets over-magnified, stuck in a loop, and how it can hijack the whole point of a jerk. This time, yes, the dopamine circuit fires off, but this time it plays its part, hands over to the next stage, and just disappears. It plays its part, then pisses off. It finds you away across the river. You continue on to step 5, mind overload, with a smirk on your face. Back to the countdown. Now we're at 3. 3. Let's get the party started. This is the same as in the previous run through. Again, no effing devices in the room. That's how this has to be. Leave space for your own mind to come up with the stuff and it will deliver. What you have to do is wait and try and wait and try, and surprisingly, the something somethings will arrive. Next step. Step 2. Next chance I get. The objective of the jerk is to A. clear the pipes, and B, sweep out that build-up of sexual thoughts in your mind. After the deed is done, the tension will be gone from your body, and your mind will be free for hours to dwell upon non-sexual thoughts and goals. This is the point of the exercise. That is the point of jerking off. Sorry to labour this, but the point of the exercise is oft forgotten. So step two gets a fuller tagline. Next chance I get to have a proper jerk. And step one, going about your day and whine. You are a sexual creature in a sexual world. Your nuts tighten up imperceptibly, and then after a while, perceptibly. Unless you can delay it with the aid of a strategically placed cool beer, the need for a jerk soon arises. Without the go-to of corn in chatrooms, you'll automatically start storing up some naughty ideas to jerk to. This is something that you did not do when relying upon screens. Why would you have? Before, it would be like you are popping out somewhere and then you notice, oh, she reminds me of a corn star. Better rush home and look at that corn. With this new approach, you'll take more time when out and about. You'll take more from the signals, social cues and scenarios of real life for your mind's own store of jerk material. Dude, is it just me or are you copying the BGOs when you step outside these days? Titillate and butt of eight city. Sex flex a plenty for you to recall when you get back to your own man cave. Oh, what's BGOs? Bulging genitalia on show.
With this new way, you may conjure up a line or a wisecrack to make some actual chick laugh and break the ice. What's erotic about that, you may ask? It's a start, a small step towards an actual flirt. Or it's a small step towards a hot flirt. That stuff is exciting. Remember what I said in step 7, how was it for you, about being a conniving dirt bird? Yeah. Those skills, they improve big time. Skills that would have lapsed due to lack of use. You'll become that guy with the quick quips and lines who are on point when the right opportunity arises. Here's that list again, in chronological order, with titles only for ease of reference. 1. Going about your day and boing. Something good in store for later. 2. Next chance I get, have a proper jerk. 3. Let's get the party started. No effing devices. 4. The search for that little something something. 5. Mind overload. 6. The nut. 7. How was it for you, dirt bird? And 8. Snooze or cruise. Just one practical point to make. Give the right way to jerk its best chance of working. If you are tired, angry, and hungry, you'll default to your usual failing shortcuts. So do the opposite. Don't be tired and hungry, and don't be worn out by the day's toll. Try this new way early in the day. That's the simple tip. Just to remind you of the overall plan, which was to break down bad habits and look at their constituents in different ways, whilst also keeping you away from your usual habits for a spell to allow room for alternative habits to develop. Next, we widen our gaze on the topic of addiction and look at it from different angles. Others online who are touching upon this issue of porn addiction. Online we have Jordan Peterson. He's forgotten more about psychology than I'll ever know. He touches on this topic of corn addiction in his speeches, podcasts, and courses. He shines a light for young men who are lost. His advice for people who want to quit corn can be searched out on YouTube. He made some great points, which I will list. Then I will come back on a few of his points that I did not quite gel with. What I mean is that his points were right, but they could have been writer. He said that novelty is needed in corn, therefore you move from one set of corn to a newer type, and you end up looking at harder and harder corn for a while. He said how men who use it feel embarrassed, ashamed and isolated. I agree, he's right. These are not good emotions to feel. And yet addicts do this stuff and feel those emotions many times daily. They do this and look the other way. What is also not good are the tricks one plays on oneself to turn one's own back on those bad feelings. He said how for most of humanity's known existence, most men only used to see about 10 hot women for their entire lifetime. Now visuals of hot women doing all sorts of erotic things are limitless. There seems to be no natural modulation for men's appetite for this limitless supply. This would explain how and why corn is so pervasive and why it is not going away. I used to hold on to a belief that one day I'd outgrow it or grow sick of it, and that is how my addiction would end. Decades in, and I was still on the same old sites doing the same old shit. So that idea did not effing pan out. I was left with a sorry view of myself. Looking back, I can see why I did not grow out of it. It was because I did not grow. The habit itself stunted my personal growth. Reference. One of Dr. Phil's life laws. Life is managed, not cured. I think that goes for P too. P is managed, not cured. Back to Peterson. Peterson makes the point that you need to think more about the middle term and long term and get away from the short term immediate self-gratification. He is right, of course. But the actual execution of this is tricky. Insights to come in this book will hopefully cut down on your setbacks as you quit that short-term gratification habit and reap the benefits of setting and meeting middle-term goals. Quitting might not be as scary as you think. He mentioned about his future authoring course. To crudely summarize it, you defined a future version of yourself that you do not want to be. You then define the future version of yourself that you do want to be, and write thoroughly upon these things. You plan, execute, and move away from the guy you do not want to be and toward the guy you do want to be. Now for some comments on pieces of Peterson's points that could have been better, in my opinion. He mentioned that if you get into a real-life relationship that works well, then you will sort of be cured of corn chatroom abuse. A coarse summary of his point. I want to make a point of my own, though. As a skilled psychotherapist and long-term happily married man, he likely has his shit going on the relationship side of things. This will be the case for a smallish percentage of guys. I think he is in the minority of guys. So a question I have is this. Yes, Peterson knows hugely about addicts in general, but does he know lots about the goings-on of corn and chatroom addicts? I think a guy with a long-term corn and chatroom addiction will likely be long-term unpartnered. I think this unpartnered cohort will also roll their eyes to the sky when they hear this "go out and get a woman" advice. Why? Because they effing tried that, got multiple rejections, got sore about it, resolved not to expose themselves to that again, said screw that for a game of tiddlywinks, and then deep-dived into the swamp of fast pleasures of the internet. Note, this is just one opinion of a 40-something man who, over his years, has not seen that many couples frolicking through flowered meadows hand in hand. You are either single or you're in some shitty little thing. I totally took that from Louis C.K., if you care to Google that or look it up on YouTube. I will not be telling you that if you redouble your efforts to find her You'll find that right girl, and then your corn chat room abuse issue will disappear. That is too idealistic, in my opinion. I prefer to work with controllables close at hand, where you make your own gains with simple small steps towards personal achievements and wins. That right girl quest does not enter into my escape plan. By all means, keep an eye out for the one, should she come along. But I think on some level, I think you know that this may come after you get your own shit together a bit. That's how I see it, at least. I'll touch upon this later again, but if you're unpartnered, you're better off looking for a one, not the one. A one, I hear you ask? A one who belongs to a personality type with whom you are compatible. That is what I meant by A1. Personality compatibility is what I am highlighting. Guys, don't be rating on talkability. Be rating on personality compatibility too. Move the needle back to a more balanced point. Dude, I hope to have you walking down the street with your chest out and chin up, a pep in your step, and being more natural with people. You'll be looking up because things will be looking up. Why? Because you'll feel good about yourself. Because you know internally that you have licked your corn and chatroom abuse problem. You'll know that you have done this for your own accord and be privately delighted with your own solid triumphs. What's more, none of that good feeling will be dependent upon external uncontrollables such as discovering the one. Peterson compared corn and chatroom addiction to drugs and alcohol addiction. He is correct, of course, but I think there are other addictions that are more closely matched. That completes my light research on what is already online regarding this topic. I think comparison to those other addictions will bear even more fruitful discoveries and insights. Slot machine addiction is one important one to mention. I will delve into that one soon.
Aside, being a guy that you don't want to be. Bay. Internal mind chatter while walking down the open plan office one day in work. Dum-de-dum-de-dum, ABC, XYZ, hot, not hot, hot, not hot, I tapped that ass. Dum-de-dum-de-dum. Pretty normal mind chatter for any guy, right? Then, from her behind, I neared a fit female workmate. Raw primal urges welled up inside. I abruptly checked my stride and sized up her body. She showed up to work that day dressed normally, by the way. Her crime was that she bore a strong resemblance to a P-star I had vigorously jerked off to the night before. It was some nasty clip that ended up with a teary-eyed star admitting to the crew how she really enjoyed the rough of it, after all. What next went on inside my head was not pretty. My limbic system grabbed the wheel. It felt like this female, 3 foot for me, was that P-star, and that it was time to reenact some P. Sexual frustration, anger, and urges to partake were right there at the surface. Her bodily safety alarms were peaked. She turned my way. I glowered and undressed her with my eyes. Unlike in a corno, she was not receptive to my intentions. Huh, who would have thought? She addressed my predatorial snarl and directed a sobering look of disappointment my way. I caught hold of myself, shirked and walked away in a pointless attempt to play the whole thing off as a nothing. I had, however, earned myself an immediate entry into a folder labelled Office Creeps to be wary of. This was a social effort. She only came in to do a day's work. She didn't come in to have some creep eye her up as if she was the last chicken in the henhouse when the fox snuck up. This was an embarrassing personal letdown. For those few seconds, I had become a guy I did not want to be. That would not have happened if I had not been heavily using hardcore P. I hear myself say hardcore P and think, there's a redundant term. What P is not hardcore these days? Let's just call it all P. P creators have been one-upping each other for years. Funny how there seems to be a connection between having a shitty day and then choosing to click into that nastier-than-usual offering served up to you by that you-may-also-like algorithm. On the radio, I heard a psychologist say that we get a dopamine hit from viewing violence. That was news to me. The primal release of adrenaline during actual play violence is old news for guys. We get that from sports or gaming or vicariously from action movies. A little act of click violence releasing dopamine. That was news to me, but it added up. This cries back to my earlier points about where a guy's jerking routine has flown right off the effing rails. Clicking into a hardcore link is sort of a screw-it act, a micro-act of violence with which we know on some level the brain gets something more. Using P means you have to watch yourself in social interactions with females. After a guy spends thousands of hours looking at P, then watching all that abnormal acting distorts what a guy thinks is normal. Expecting a normal female to react like a P-star might react on receipt of a creepy advance. That's the sort of thing where it leads to. As a result, there then arises a requirement to be on guard against social faux pas like the one I just described. It becomes necessary to keep your genteel mask always carefully up. Lapses that expose your nasty thoughts and urges are bad for your social rating. This guarding means you cannot be natural with yourself, which in turn means you are not natural with females. And, newsflash of the century, they pick up on that shit. It's as if you're slinking around wearing a veil of guilt, as if you are avoiding your debt collector. It restrains your voice, your flow, and confines your body language. You act like a constricted version of yourself. Guys who use P daily will be having less and less natural chats with females. That means diminishing chat-up skills, less successes, building sexual frustration, and building resentment. That in turn means leaning into P in chatrooms more. Tired, blanket generalizations about women develop within you. Fast, icy misogyny coats your eyes. You are then being sold short by your very own perceptions and totally unaware of it. The consequences of heavy P use eventually catch up with a guy. Back in the early days of use, there was basically no consequences, so that changed. I did not see that effect coming when I got into P chat rooms. I don't think any guy sees that one coming. This was an aside to remind the listener of another reason why it could be a good idea to change direction. After you leave this stuff behind, the ice melts away and you can take a fairer view of the fairer sex. End of aside. Comparisons to other habits. Now for some comparisons, plus breakdowns with other addictions to help you see some of your own habits in a new light. There are three things I will cover. It goes fast food, then overeating, then the most important and closest to home comparison of all for the corn chatroom addict. It is that of gambling slot machines. In each, I present the problem and some solutions. A steady eye is kept on the overall objective, which is to get you thinking about your corn chatroom addiction differently. I could add to the list more addictions, like drink and drugs, both over-the-counter and street, but I decided to leave them aside in the interest of brevity and focus. Fast food and corn chatroom abuse similarities. This is part one of two. There are lots of similarities between fast food abuse addiction and corn chatroom addiction. Fast food is a massive topic. I don't claim to be an expert on this topic. My observations aim to help you see crossovers and commonalities between abusing fast food and abusing corn and chatrooms. It would be too crowded if I were to jam all my points and observations into one section. I'm going to make two passes at this topic. First pass on fast food now. What to call it? Fast food or junk food?
or convenience food. It's all the same in my view. Fast food is the phrase I'll be sticking with, though. Onward. Square one. Let's talk about fast food and how it does a number on you. Something salty, something sweet, something fatty, something hot, something oily, something cool, something crunchy, mouthfeel, something smooth. One always leads onto the other in the fast food world. Salty and sweet understate what food engineers have transformed these tastes into. A ton of tweaking, refining, and intensifying has been done to make them taste like more and generate more repeat sales. You have one tidbit and immediately salivate for another one. Have a pucking another one is how I'll name this stuff. Default chemical impulses to have a pucking another one win out time and time again until the packet is empty. Salt and sugar and fat have been refined and processed and made more potent than anything nature would serve up in the wild. Fast food looks terrific to the eye. The customer salivates at the anticipation of the lip-smacking taste and imminent savoury sweet taste sensations upon the tongue. The eyes, the nose, the mouth are super stimulated even before you bite and chew. It's effing great, and it's meant to be, by design. You swallow it down and forget about it. There's a bit more going on than a hungry person eating something to satisfy their hunger, isn't there? With the taste buds going crazy, you can't ever get enough. Once the supply stops, your taste buds and thirst buds crave more. Messages from your gut like, "I'm full, thank you," do they get a look in? F no. A pizza, for instance, would be terrific when you behold it and chew it down. However, how does your gut and your blood feel about it afterwards? How great do you feel after it? Sweaty, uncomfortable, and glued to the sofa. No? Is that you? Consider the question, how does your gut plus bloodstream feel about what you have just consumed? Did all that processed salt leave you with an ungodly thirst and raised blood pressure? It is lavish looking and packs a Moorish taste bud bonanza. And hey, who gives a rat's crap about consumers' gut health or consumers' bloodstreams? The answer is no one does. That is, no one wants to make a healthy profit. There's quite a number being pulled on you. Convenience food is very convenient for their profits, but very inconvenient on your gut and your bloodstream. Basically, there are two halves in the chain of recipients of your fast food gorge. First half, eyes, nose and mouth. Second half, gut plus bloodstream. The first half gets served fast, opulent pleasure, and the second half gets screwed over. Another takeaway from this book is that you need to have your eyes open as to what is getting effed over in the name of fast pleasure. For fast food, it's your gut and bloodstream. For corn, what is getting effed over is the proper clear out of your pipes and the sweep out of the mind's erotic thoughts. To continue the fast food experience and return to where it started, you'll soon have forgotten that crappy, sweaty, post-gorge feeling and within a few days be unconsciously salivating at the glimpse of a certain bright label from the corner of your eye. Bing! It's in your shopping cart. You'll be repeating the whole routine and be wolfing back the same pizza and chasing it back with a soft drink to get that dizzying sugar rush. Or whatever your high is. Fast, crap food can have you stuck in a loop of taste bud pleasure followed by a glucose crash followed by chasing the fix. When that crash hits your stomach, it grumbles and it growls. You are edgy and you chew on your nails until you get to that next snack. And in between snacks, your dopamine circuit fires off as teases from your next snack present. These are problems someone who eats well does not have. Then we have the effect of normalizing, desensitizing, or acclimating. This seems to be a big capability of human beings. It can work for you or against you. For instance, take a guy with a sweet tooth. His tolerance levels are already high. Say that same guy wants a sugar high after a very stressful few hours. How much effing sugar is it going to take to hit that mark.
Yuck. Over years, with the habitual consumption, what you consider a normal flatline level of X will unnoticed to yourself creep higher and higher. When you zoom out on the timeline and look at the graph from afar, that plateau you thought you were on is not so level. It has been climbing. Imperceptibly, your normal level creeps up to a level that leads to a perceptible damage level. I'll coin a term for this as silent ascent. You can insert whatever you like for X above, be that junk food, sugar, drugs, alcohol, corn in chat rooms, gaming, social media, the list goes on. The breakaway from fast food. You have been left totally ignorant of your gut's own messages. They have been forgotten about. Conditioned ignorance, dare I say. One of the keys to getting away from junk food is to see through the money-grabbing motivations of the food engineers and marketers. See them for what they are. Behave like it. Yield not. By exploiting our weaknesses, they exert their will over yours. That's what's going on. The path away from that is those silly normal levels must be flatlined, zeroed, and kept there. Kept there for weeks. Then the body adjusts. This gives things like taste and cravings a chance to reset. If your normal levels are silly high, then what good will cutting back by 20% really do? You would still be in the land of silly high. That's why the graph line has got to plummet over the cliff edge and get set to zero. You know those have a poking another one foods? Toss them into the bin. That's what this means. Toss them into the bin. As you break away from old patterns, your judgment improves. You move towards foods with more genuine, kinder motivations behind them. Another shout out here to the Buddhists. They encourage you to ask, what are the motivations behind X, Y, Z? Ask this of anything in your everyday life. Ask, what are the motivations? You'll be seeing many things differently then. As you walk around the supermarket, you'll catch yourself salivating when some bright packaging caught your eye. You'll catch yourself and stop the chain of events that used to be your silly old pattern. Basically, for the healthier eater, for their food decisions, they put their gut and their bloodstream first. What gets served first? Answer is the gut and bloodstream. The point of the exercise is oft forgot. Taste buds, nose and eyes get served after that. They tie for second place or lower. As you get used to it, you get to like how your gut and bloodstream thank you for giving them what they needed. They thank you for giving them their requirements when they needed it. You get a much nicer, fuller, and long-lasting thank you from your gut than you would ever get from satisfying the pestering cravings for junk food from your mouth, nose, and eyes. Your eyes, nose, and mouth now get on board with what your gut needs. You can eat something and have a happy, calm gut. You can then go for hours. It's the polar opposite of what junk food does. You can thrive from the sustained energy. No more rotten glucose spikes and crashes. Sweets become sickly sweet. What's more, you can become free of the silly cravings that have nothing got to do with the true hunger messages coming from the bloodstream and gut. After resetting your taste buds, bad cravings stop, snacking goes away, and you eat at decent intervals. Post-gorge phrases such as, I'm going to pay for that, or, oh, I've overeaten, they get consigned to history. Resetting your taste buds mean you stop super stimulating them for a few weeks. The way is then clear for sense to come into your eating. Eat when you are hungry, stop eating when you are full, eat consciously. That's a Derren Brown reference. Derren Brown is a famous mentalist and can be found with a YouTube search. If it's needed, weight loss will come as you level off and stabilize at a more natural weight for your genetics and age. By putting the gut and bloodstream before the mouth, nose and eyes, your body thanks you and rewards you. On the subtle side of things, you will look at fresh, unprocessed, that is to say, not manipulated by man, food, and sort of know that your gut would love it. For example, raw kelp is really tasty in the mouth, and so calming for the gut, and good for the blood. The phrase, listen to your gut, actually comes into daily practice. That's it for this pass on fast food. To summarise, in the case of fast food, it was the vocal minority. It was the loud pesterings of eyes, nose and mouth, shouting down the quiet voice of the placid and vital gut and bloodstream. For the case of corn and chatrooms, it is the pestering of the eyes and the dopamine circuit, shouting down the more placid calls of your own pipes' tensions. In both cases, the first gets opulent instant gratification, the second gets effed over. The escape from corn and chatrooms centres around making your pipes and body the first serve. The eyes and dopamine circuit get served by the by. The coolers are put on dopamine circuitry firing off. It is kept in its place. To commandeer world-famous magician's Derren Brown sentence, jerk when you are horny, don't jerk when you are not horny. Jerk consciously. Conscious of what need is getting served, and conversely, conscious of what need is not to be served. Remember what I said earlier about the first takeaway from this book? Remember I mentioned about coming good all the time? Does that make more sense now? Fast food and corn similarities, part 2 of 2. Here's the second pass at this topic. It comes at it from another side. In part 1 of 2, I focused on cravings and impulses. This time, the focus is on where a junk food abuser goes and why. For short, I will use the term overeater as I expand upon this topic. So it is where the overeater goes and why. I mean, where in the mind and being do they go, and why? This place is where one's own sorry self-view falls away. This place is where the rotten, stressful world falls away. Time falls away, and one is soothed and cosy. A familiar, easy, safe place that is the opposite to the awkward outer world. This is a very human thing to do, to go to such a safe place. Examples. People can be in a mindless haze looking at mindless TV and be gently polishing off a full packet of biscuits or cookies. People may like the push-out feeling of food against their gut wall at the end of a feast and the associated lightheadedness. People may seek out a dizzying sugar rush because a buzz is a break. And why does someone go there? Some reasons. The following list may hit tender spots for people. How shall I put this? There is something for everybody in the following list of reasons. Well, why not go to that self-soothing activity? The reality is the overeater knows there is a health price to be paid for habitually residing in the false haven. And to that they say, I'm effing going there anyway. F it. This is where a psychologist would help such a person run down the chain of exploratory questions. This is emotional stuff and individual to each. If that describes you, then I encourage you to spend a few sessions with a psychologist. It is a decisive act of self-care that allows you to step away from one's own familiar, crappy, repetitive cycles. You'll be leaving your first session in a great mood. Continuing on with the whys, because they don't have anywhere better to go. Some people are stuck in lifeless, dull places. Why do they do this sort of thing? Well, how about that they are as unhappy as F inside and they just need a break from things? They could feel ugly and insecure inside. A safe, cozy place can be a painkiller. Maybe there is more than painkilling going on. Combinations of things that end up in the bloodstream can yield short-term pleasures too. A stay in the cozy place can be an escape from not knowing what the effing direction to go in or what effing to do with yourself in life. Coping with being somebody you hate by taking a short holiday from one's own headspace. Going to this place numbs a person from things like shame and humiliation of not fitting in. You can run from guilty feelings. The place may be where a punishment is carried out on oneself, using one sort of pain to distract from another, if you will. The place can be a numb place, numbed to the depression and overwhelm of a results-based world that is just too fast. The place could be surrounded by a high wall, and kept outside of that wall are unaddressed emotions that the person is totally unaware of. The place could be something that you have control of, which contrasts to the out-of-control crap in your daily life. Maybe this habit was all learned from family. Never seen anything different? The expression monkey see, monkey do comes to mind. Also add to that expression, monkey see nothing else, monkey do nothing else. Aside, George Frederick Kunz was an American mineral collector in the first half of the 20th century. End of aside. More reasons that can have a person wind up in their false haven. Being stuck in a rut. Being stuck in a rut and not realizing. Because it's easy. Because it is familiar. Keeping in step with a peer group. Being depressed. Too little sleep. Under stress. Because I am the king of the sad George Fredericks. Susceptibility. Brain damage. Habit. The place could be where you, as a creature of habit, will return without so much as one thought. Habit. It's the most innocuous one of all. We acquire habits so easily and then forget that they even exist. The fact that this list could easily be longer speaks to how tricky it is out there. So many traps for a person to fall into on their path through life. At this point, it is time to exhale and thoughtfully pat one another on the back, exhale again, and with that say, it's not so easy out there. That list may have been uncomfortable to hear. Personally, I ran to my safe haven so many times and reluctantly returned oh so many times for many reasons. To mention one, for example, I did this to block out and run from difficult emotions around loneliness and lack of connection. As one gets older, you don't get to hang out with your old friends as much. Everyone has less time than they had in their youths, and everyone keeps their guards higher up too. I knew I needed to make some friends. So where did I default to? The same old chatroom haunts, of course. Like that was ever going to work out. Anyhow. How to replace the false haven. Be vigilant of your own stress build-up. Catch yourself and course correct. Journaling and diaries are super useful toward that end. Each time we go to an addiction, it is to soothe an internal pain, an internal stress that reared up inside, thanks to life's daily trials, I guess. To pin down and name when and what bad feeling arose is a tool to strip power from addictive activities. What advice would you give to a friend who had what you had? When you look at a page of your own writing, the pull of the addictive activity is weakened. What did I get wrong? What did I get right? Playing with questions like that will get the ink flowing. By calling out these things to yourself when they happen each day, you can interrupt silent habit defaults. This is an application of that popular term, self-awareness. Being mindful of your choices and not just defaulting to what your usual is helps. Putting stopgaps and delays in between you and your device gives time for the mindful thoughts to arise. Listen, turn off your phone once a day. The world won't end while it is off. In the interim, you can look out of a window and not think. Bring your attention to your breath. This is Meditating 101. Be in the present. It actually kind of sucks. So much mind chatter. However, what is noticing the mind chatter? This can grow. Build up low self-esteem. If your head is effed, work on your body. If your body is effed, work on your head. Give yourself better places to go. Cheaply spending a large portion of your day on a chat room is a choice of self-disrespect. A choice of self-respect is to give yourself better places to go. The places can be mental states of mind or actual physical locations, like parks, river walks, sports events, other events, gymnasiums, or concert hall. You get the idea. Treat yourself and visit a psychologist and explore reasons for poor self-esteem. As mentioned previously, loneliness and lack of connection was the issue that drove me to live all my life online. So how does one solve loneliness? I admit, I do not know. Here are two things, though, that are working for me so far. A. In the dating world, I finally figured out that looking for a date with someone with a compatible personality type was the way to go. You are not looking for the one, you are better off looking for A1. A1 who belongs to a personality type compatible with your own. To discover your own personality type and the personality types with which you are compatible, Google Myers-Briggs 16 personality types. And if that does not do it for you, try Ocean personality types. Jordan Peterson uses these. One other loneliness fix. I have found that the company of a pet gives a warm feeling inside. Better to have a dopamine uptick from your pet's greeting than from an app notification, eh? This concludes the section on how to escape your false haven. This also wraps up the past two of two about fast food and corn chatroom similarities. Next, the third comparison is detailed. Slot machine addiction, the most apt comparison of the three mentioned. The best and closest comparison I can make to being a corn chatroom addict is to that of being a gambling slot machine addict. The following section is from a terrific documentary found on YouTube. Basically, the Australians have had a nationwide problem with pokies, as they call them, for a long time. A documentary maker there put together a masterpiece. It is probably so good because the creators knew loved ones damaged by the pokies. There are lessons and warnings and many to be heeded from it. They cited a terrific book called Addiction by Design. If you want to know about the nuts and bolts of this thing, that book is ideal. Slot machines are machines of addiction. Addiction by Design. Perfect addiction machines is a quote that an ex-addict gave for that documentary. Decades of testing, design, innovation, trials, and tuning have gone into those things. Top question, what do these machines get the user addicted to? The buzz of gambling? Yes, well, Are there more addictive things being cultivated? The answer is F, yes. Public enemy number one, the dopamine circuits are massively exploited in gambling machines. They figured out how to exploit it decades before computer chips or computer games or mobile phones were even dreamt of. I mentioned how the tease and chase, then thrill or spill, is a trio that fizzes and whizzes the dopamine circuit round and round. Think expectation and think anticipation, followed by a sweet treat or a stressing failure. Slot machines have concentrated the dopamine upticks and downticks as follows. Potential rewards are constantly dangled in front of the player. Excitement is building. Rewards are on the way. Expectancy heightening. Wins are tailored to reward the player just enough to keep them playing, but are kept rare. That way the player loses over time. Wins are wholeheartedly celebrated with the player. That's conditioning. Losses are minimized to the player. More conditioning. And a step beyond that is when losses are dressed up as wins. Bing! Congratulations, you just won $10. Whisperer. Well, the fact of the matter is the house is actually up $15 overall this session. But hey, who's counting? Devilishly, losses are portrayed as near misses. Oh, you were so, so close that time. This is teasing. And they are presented to the losing player at an artificially high rate. That's pure manipulation. As dictated by regulators, wins must have a low yet reasonable probability. However, as for near misses, they are allowed to be depicted at an unreasonably high frequency. No regulations against that. Ain't that cute? The player gets mainline, dopamine upticks, and a few downticks. They lose sense of time and self. They lose sense of financial losses. They are lost in a zone where the outside world and its associated difficulties falls into the background. The machine playing experience purrs and pulses and flows with sights and sounds constantly. This is mesmerizing. You can bet every 3 seconds. Fast repeatability of bets is vital to ensnare the player. As one graphical designer of the machine said, hold them with a strong stare. Dude, I don't know about you, but that phrase chilled me to the bone. Remember that one for later. The player can have many bets on the go at once. Complexity and progression of bet speed prowess are being fostered here. It is another arena in which the player gets more and more invested. The harder it is to get in, the harder it is to get out. Seats are ergonomic to lengthen your stay. People's innate sense of community and sense of safety in numbers are being used against them for games. They cluster player in high visibility locations and provide free snacks and sometimes free breakfast. The unsuspecting player is subjected to an onslaught of conditioning, reinforcement, and mesmerizing techniques, and combinations thereof. These are tuned to relieve the player of everything in their wallet and on their card, and to keep them coming back in search of a trancy feeling. When the player put in a few bucks for their very first flutter, did they know of any of this? There were player stories where their hands were shaking crazily as they popped in for a few bucks of what was meant to be a quick game. Anyone find that detail familiar? Hands shaking on the keyboard and mouse on a Saturday morning perv session. Player said how a win was actually an annoying, twitchy, tense thing. Why tense, you may ask? Surely there is a buzz of the win. What was going on was that the player was harshly snapped out of a trance they were in. That speaks to the gravity of this trance. Wins on these machines are always small in comparison to accumulated, not to be mentioned losses. Therefore, why would the player be totally thrilled? It's not like they will take the win cut their losses, walk away, and make sensible use of that cash. The player compliantly knows their next step in this dance. What's coming is more game time, even if they are sick of it, until empty wallet time arrives, which is then followed by that walk of shame. At this moment, there is not much left of that phony player community vibe. The player will leave the venue with nerves whizzing and trying to do their best to minimise and ignore what just happened. If they lose big, they will tell themselves that they feel cleansed on some level, as if that was what they needed for a new beginning. A couple of days later, they seem to get the bright idea to return and win back some of those losses.
Under the hood, what is going on is that the mind has generated a craving to get back on that fizzing dopamine wheel. The memory lends a hand here and gives some euphoric recall. Euphoric recall is a term borrowed from experts in the addiction field. It is self-explanatory. The aftermath of euphoric recall leaves the addict experiencing uncomfortable, unspoken, repeated whizzing, random bodily stresses. To alleviate this, the mind sets upon creating some narrative. Cue the addict think. Addict default, rather. What the narrative is about does not matter. All these narratives are toward the same end, the end of returning to the slot machine, returning to that source of the fix. Some narrative samples. Justifications. I've been busting my ass recently. Time for a little treat. And I have amassed a great deal of inside knowledge and skill on this pursuit. I can't just forget about all those hard yards that I have gained, can I? This time I've got a better plan. She won't miss the money out of her account for a day. It'll all be back there tomorrow. Distraction narrative samples. I've got to get some shit done, like searching for a better job so I can get away from that shitty boss of mine. I just can't face that right now. I wonder what I might do to delay dealing with that. Punishment narrative samples. Cue some delightful self-talk. Where do you belong? Whisper. This is your lot. You know where you belong. An excuse narrative example. I was just passing down the street on my way to the DIY store and I thought I'd drop in for 10 minutes. I'm just going to gamble only a little bit this time to prove to myself that I don't actually have a problem. End of narrative samples. So, that told the personal side. The relationship between player and slot machine. The documentary was super revealing about the powerful forces supporting the slot machine industry. Comedian Louis C.K. has a bit about what he would do if he won $1 billion. YouTube search, if I had $1 billion, Louis C.K. To paraphrase it, he would set up a totally pervasive nationwide chain of shops called Pet Effers. People would be weirded out by them at first, but after a while people would begin to just accept that those outlets were where you bring your pets to be effed. It would no longer be cool to ask such an uncool question as, why would I want to have my pet effed? Cooler not to ask such things. That way you look slick. A huge seed of truth in there about how there comes a tipping point regarding people's perception of how popular something is. Before that tipping point, then it's not popular enough to bother with. Past that tipping point, it becomes a must-have. Now it has become a signal to the herd that yes, I am one of you. What's more, you may even want to signal to the inner sanctum of the herd that you're actually one of the inner set. If you need to signal that, then you're in luck.
you can take your pet to Deluxe Pet Effers. In Australia, they put enough slot machines in enough places for enough decades that Aussies sort of unknowingly accepted it that it was an Aussie thing to do. Sounds bizarre until you learn that a nice percentage of the takings went to the government. Where this grows legs is that there were more people with vested interests in local and state governments saying, "Look at how much revenue we're getting from these pokies," than there were people saying, "Look at the devastation this is causing to the lives of the addicts." It gets better. There were lobbyists and PR firms hired to protect this profitable industry from driven regulators and do-gooders. A big trick was to spin the debate as being about something else. Another tactic was to create a non-profit organisation to give to local charities. Their charitable giving was a modicum of the profits that their founders were extracting. Industry people put the onus on players to regulate themselves. This deflects attention away from the systems and governments that are not looking out for the uneducated and the unsuspecting and the susceptible. The industry says 90% of players know when to stop. If that's true, a big if, that leaves 10% who have a problem with their machines of addiction. But the addiction word is dirty. A slot machine industry calls those 10% habitual gamers. By the way, that 10% is responsible for delivering 80% of the profit. Those poor bastards, habitual gamers, are targeted, so they keep on coming back and back. From that 10% come the stories of mental health loss, marriages lost, jobs lost, homes lost, businesses lost, relationships lost, years lost, and untimely deaths, etc., etc. People are dying to feed their addictions all the time. Phrases such as electronic crack cocaine is how their slot machines are described by members of that 10%. The takeaway here is that, systematically, no one is coming to rescue the addicts. Industry and government are doing too well from these machines. This concludes the section on slot machine addiction. I counted about 17 ploys that carry over to the online chatroom world.
Aside, three concepts. At this point, I would like to point out three concepts that humans say they get, but they don't act like they get. They are A. Randomness. B. Infinity. C. Safety in crowds. A. Randomness. Subcategories of note here are randomness hidden in plain sight, and especially randomness cloaked falsely as a pattern. Randomness means patterns. If something has a pattern, then you quite possibly will know what the next piece of the pattern will be. For example, 2, 4, 6, 8. Fair enough. No pattern at all gives you randomness. If something is random, the whole point of it is that you do not and will not know what piece is coming up next. Humans naturally expect to find patterns. A plausible explanation for this natural inclination is seen in how babies learn to speak. So it's rather useful. So, to repeat the opening statement of the paragraph, randomness means patterns. If something is random, you ain't going to get a pattern. That's the plain and simple message here. How do you randomize things? You scramble them up.